So I think the first question I'd love to ask is, what was your initial influence, or like, what initially happened that got you into the politics of resistance? What got you interested in environmentalism?
So have we started? Do you want me to go ahead and answer?
Yeah. If that's okay. I can give you some of the other questions, and you can ponder over them.
That's great.
Okay.
Well, there's really several threads that came together. One of the threads is that when I was a child, my father was extremely violent, and he broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And even when I was a kid, I recognized that, or I was sort of asking without using these words, you know, what, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And so in some ways that set me off on a path of asking, why do people do these horribly destructive things? And so that was one thread. And another thread is when I was in second grade, so I was about 7, there was a subdivision went in right next to where I lived, and it destroyed meadows and cottonwood trees, and it destroyed lots of habitat for, didn't use the word habitat in second grade, lots of homes for meadowlarks and grasshoppers and ants and garter snakes and like I said, cottonwood trees. And I remember thinking, even in second grade, you know, if they keep doing this forever, they'll run out of room. And also, if they keep doing this, where is everybody else going to live, all these non-humans? So, once again, I didn't have the language, but in second grade, I recognized that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And then let's fast forward to when I was in college. I got a degree in engineering and physics, mineral engineering physics, and I didn't really enjoy it, but I was doing it because I got a scholarship, and if you can get a scholarship in engineering and get a really good job afterwards, you're crazy if you don't do that. So most of the people I knew who were also attending this college they didn't really like it. They weren't enjoying themselves, but the reason they were doing it is because when they got out, they would make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started at that time asking people if they like, just random people, just people like on a bus or at a city park or anywhere, I would just ask people if they like their jobs. About 90% would say no. And so I started asking the question, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? That seems crazy. I mean, who's actually benefiting from this? This whole system is just nuts, because it's not even making most people happy. And so then let's fast forward a couple more years, and I was in my mid-20s, and I was not really doing any activism, I wasn't doing any activism, and I didn't, the problems, it seemed really clear that the problems are really huge and really overwhelming, and I didn't know how to get started, and anything I would do would be just too trivial. And then one day I realized that I wasn't, this is the smartest thing I ever did, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas, by which I mean that paying, at the time gas was, I don't know, $1.20 a gallon or something, and me paying that was not covering the social and ecological costs of gasoline, of oil extraction and gas, and refining gas and burning gas. And so I decided that for every dollar I spent on gas, I would either give a dollar to a local environmental organization, not a national one because they're terrible, but to a local environmental organization, or since I didn't have any money myself, what I would do is I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. So I started off by just writing letters to the editor, and it's pretty funny because, of course, you know, my stuff is you know, I'm known for taking some positions that are pretty out there. But at the time, I was too scared to even sign my own name to letters to the editor. So I would write them under false names. And also, after writing some letters to the editor, I would. So anyway, the point is that if I would, if I spent $10 on gas that week, that means that I would have to do 2 hours of work. So I might write one letter to the editor. And then after that, I started doing anti-circus demonstrations, anti-fur demonstrations, and then from there moved to doing timber sale appeals. And pretty soon I was having enough fun doing the activism that I was doing way more than I was having to. And you know, that's really how I got started in that. And then one more step to add is... So I'm doing this activism, just sort of showing up at demonstrations or pretty much doing it on my own. And then I met this guy, John Osborne, who became my environmental mentor and a dear friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he really channeled my energy. You know, it's a lot of us, I think, have just a sort of inchoate energy that we understand a lot of stuff's wrong, but we don't really know what to do. And he was able to, you know, sort of be my elder and to help me figure out directions to go. And I think that's really... really helpful too, in terms of, you know, as a young person, I think it's very important to have, even though John's only a few years older than I am, he was much more experienced than I, and I think it's really important to have that sort of intergenerational connection in activism or in anything really, because when you're starting out with anything, you're an apprentice. You know, you're gonna you're gonna make mistakes and you're gonna do ridiculous things and you're going to. And this doesn't matter whether you are a young basketball player, excuse me, or a young car mechanic, or a young activist, or a young writer. It doesn't matter. I mean, you're going to do things that are not very good because you're inexperienced, and it's really good to have somebody of an older generation who can say, "Yeah, I remember when I made that mistake, and here's why that's a mistake." And anyway, so John was able to really channel me into my activism. So that's sort of the short version of how I got involved. And I guess another part is that, you know, I recognized, so right now we're up to my maybe 28, 29, and I'm in I'm living in Spokane, Washington, and you know, I'm doing the activism, and I recognized that privately almost all the activists I knew fully recognize that this culture is inherently unsustainable, and basically all of us were just hanging on by our fingernails, hoping to protect, you know, this or that creature or this or that piece of land until the whole system would come down. And yet we weren't talking about that in public. In public we had to act like this system can go on, and that's well, and that leads to really, I guess, one more piece of the puzzle, which is that, so I saw, you know, there's a line by my friend Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan writer and activist, and she has, I asked her once what she thought of an attack by one writer on another writer, and she said, well, if he didn't like it, he should write his own book, and that really stuck with me. I think that's very, very good advice, and that's what I did in my own life, is that I saw a hole in discourse, and the hole, and there's many holes, but one of them is sort of a militant environmental resistance. You know, you can have some militant feminist resistance and writing, militant feminist writing. You can have some militant American Indian writing. You can have militant African American writing, and you know, the right wingers are obviously very militant. But among environmentalists, I mean, it was all just sort of touchy-feely and feel
very
good. And there's
very
pacifist. I'm sorry.
Very pacifist.
Very pacifist, and also this complete addiction to pretending things aren't nearly as bad as they are. And and so I saw that hole in discourse, and instead of just complaining about it, or I guess in addition to complaining about it, because I did that too, in addition to complaining about it, it's like, well, okay, I'm going to fix that. I'm going to fill that hole.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, also a really important lesson, because if so often, you know, people will have all sorts of great ideas, or they'll see a problem and then they'll just complain about it. But it's like, okay, there's a problem. And people write to me all the time and they'll say, you know, there's this huge problem, there's this. And I'll write back and say, well, okay, so it sounds like you've got a lot of energy about that. Why don't you take it on?
Mm.
And of course, I never hear from them again for the most part. But that's the thing, is actually the you know, the last half of that story, I mean, the first half of that story is about, you know, things that helped me understand that things were wrong. And the last half of that story is really about getting off my butt and doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's, you know, it's one of the things I am desperately trying to do with all of my work, is to get people to start doing stuff. I mean, if we had the numbers, this is one of the things that breaks my heart. Where do you live, by the way?
I live in Michigan, on the west side of Michigan.
Okay. I live in far northern California,
mm-hmm.
and that's known for, among other things, known for marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, the medical marijuana Prop 215, you know, sort of led the country in that. And the way the number of plants, there's going to be a point to this story, don't worry.
Okay.
The way the number of plants you can have is determined county by county. So some counties will say you can only have 3 plants or 5 plants, and other counties say you can have, you know, a lot more plants. And this county here at one point said you could have 99 plants. That's how many would be medically acceptable. Mm-hmm. And the county was going to try to drop that. And it was actually pretty cool. And this is how participatory democracy is supposed to work. The county supervisors, that'd be in other states, county commissioners, the county supervisors were going to drop it, and the place was completely packed. And, mm-hmm. you know, the people were rebelling. It's like, you will not lower that number. And they were saying this, you know, because they've got arthritis, because they've got these other conditions, or, you know, frankly, some of them were there because they want to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring all this up is because that's participatory democracy in action. But the thing that broke my heart is that it was packed over marijuana. And if there's something where they're going to, the county supervisors want to screw over the Klamath River, you know, 4 people show up.
Right.
And it breaks my heart because I wish that people loved salmon the way they love their marijuana. And so, but my point back to the original thing is that the first step is to get off your butt and do something, you know, is to go... And to go and talk about, you know, medical marijuana or whatever it is, that's another thing that people write to me all the time, and they say, you know, I don't know what to do. And I always say, you know, what are you really good at? And also, what just fires you up? What is it that you love? And, like, I've got this friend, and then I'll shut up and you can ask me another question. I've got this friend in New York, Charlotte Watson, who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York. She's a fabulous activist, and she does wonderful work. And she's amazing. She asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? She will, like, I mean, don't get on the subway with this woman, because she is relentless. She's wonderful. And I would not ask her to, you know, hey, why don't you instead work on salmon issues?
Right.
Because that's the great thing about everything being so messed up, is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. So if your issue is, like, there are some people I talked to a couple of weeks ago, or maybe several weeks ago, about frac sand mining in mm-hmm. Wisconsin, that it's just devastating the area.
Yeah, it's a big thing here too in this area.
Exactly. So, you know, I wouldn't ask you to work on salmon issues because there's no salmon there.
No, there's a ton, but I live right by Lake Michigan. But no, I understand your point, obviously. Sorry.
Oh no, that's it. So that's sort of the quick path.
So I guess my next question would be, you're also pretty renowned for being an ally to Indigenous people and to Indigenous people's movements. Was that something that kind of was linked to your, fight with environmentalism, or was that a separate issue that you came across while being involved in activism?
Well, in some ways they're very linked.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to always be linked in every way, but in many ways they are linked. And one of the ways they're linked is that, you know, I mentioned my friend John Osborne earlier, and
mm-hmm.
One of the lines that he used to say a lot, which I think is really true, is that a lot of activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because if you start asking, why is this land being destroyed, oftentimes the answer is to make money. And so the next question is, why would you have, why is any land being destroyed, not just this land? And then once you, it's always the same answer, or it's usually the same answer. And so then the next question is, why would you have an entire economic system that's based on destroying the land that you need to live?
Right.
And then the next question would be, how long has this been going on? And the next question is this inherent to humans? And then what you'll find is that, like where I live, is Talawa land and Talawa Indian. And the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years before mm-hmm. the arrival of dominant culture. That's if you believe the myth of science. If you believe the myth of the Talawa, they lived just since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, they lived here for a long time. I was just talking to a friend a couple of days ago about how long do you think people have to live in place before you can tell that they're living sustainably? And then the answer we came up with was we think 5,000 years. Because
wow.
in 1,000 years, you can be destroying the place sort of subtly and might not notice. Obviously, with industrialism, you destroy it a lot faster. But
right. But I mean, even if you look at Europe, they're not necessarily living, sustainably, and they've
well, they're not now, for, certainly.
Right, and I don't know that they were since Rome really took over.
Well, that's exactly the point. Is
right.
That's exactly when my friend and I were talking, we were trying to figure out so how long, and I pointed out that between 500 AD and 1500 AD, or at current era, I guess 500 CE and 1500 CE,
mm-hmm.
Europe was certainly harmed, but it wasn't harmed. It was not sustainable, but
right.
the harm wasn't as grievous as it has been since then. It was still sort of declining. So the point is that the Talawa were here for at least 12,500 years, and they didn't destroy the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were. We can point to many places around the world where people have lived in place for a long time without destroying it. And so that's one of the ways if you start to ask then, so how were they living differently? What were some of the differences that caused them to be able to live without destroying the place? And so that's one of the ways that that I got my entree into working with indigenous peoples too, is through I mean some of the strongest advocates for salmon, like I said, I started really working in eastern Washington, and that's a big salmon region.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some of the strongest advocates for the salmon are the tribes of the Indian nations up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're going to be working on those issues, you're probably going to be encountering members of Indian nations who are advocating alongside you, or you're advocating alongside them, I should say. So that's really where that began. And then also, the two ways it began. One is through the direct advocacy with them, and the other is through recognizing that, the Indians who live along the Columbia River, they had hard-headed treaties among the different peoples that would last for 500 years. I mean, yeah, they have different relationships with the natural world entirely, and they also had these treaties that were hard-headed policy agreements that it wasn't just sort of, oh, wow, a spiritual relationship with the salmon, although that's very important. I'm not making fun of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's really crucial. But at the same time, they also just had these, here's how many fish we can take. And then we have to leave fish for the Indians upstream. We got to leave fish for the grizzly bears. We got to leave fish for the salmon. Got to leave fish for everybody else. And so it was not, it was on every level from the policy to the spiritual, where they were living in different ways. So if you're going to ask, why are we living unsustainably, or how are we living unsustainably, then one of the questions you have to ask too is, well, then how have human beings lived sustainably?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that all started.
I've listened to a lot of your stuff, and I've read your books since I was probably 18. That gives me away a little bit, for my age. I'm 25 now, but one thing that I've always wanted to ask you is, do you think that civilization will have to crash in a foul swoop, or do you believe that over time it can be slowly disassembled and people can begin living more sustainably, you know, almost in the way that we see now with, like, the new wave of, like, maybe try going vegan or, you know, don't use so much electricity? Or do you think that it's a thing that's inevitably just going to come crashing down?
Well, I don't... I mean, every cell in my body wants for us to have some sort of voluntary transformation.
Right.
Where people come to their senses and they begin doing things a lot. I mean, they begin to care about the natural world and to do the right thing. And but also every cell in my body knows that's not going to happen.
Right.
And, which is why I wrote Endgame. I mean, that's the fundamental question of Endgame is, you know, I would ask, before I wrote Endgame, I was touring, doing lots of talks, and I was asking people all over the country, do you believe that we're going to undergo, this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living? And nobody ever said yes.
Right.
And so the next question is, if you don't, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the and Endgame came out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish that we were going to, and we could, you know, if we were, if this culture weren't insane, we could have a voluntary transformation where, I mean, if I were made, you know, emperor of all things economy, the first thing I would do, I mean, this is a joke really, but the first thing I would do is outlaw retractable stadium roofs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just take these things that are so egregious, and I would get rid of lawns, you know? It's like,
sure.
there are ways that things could be much, and I would, here's the real thing I would do, is that capitalism is completely based on subsidies, and I would just change the subsidies away from deforestation to reforestation, and I would change water policy such that the way water policy is handled in the West is different than the Eastern United States. In the Western United States, it's first in time, first in right, which is the first person who used it for a quote beneficial use could, that's how you get the, it's basically finders keepers.
Okay.
So if somebody shows up at the Colorado River and they want to use 1 million gallons a day to water an apple orchard, then that means they've got rights to a million acres for however, whatever time, you know, I said it was, I don't remember.
Yeah.
And that would, and you get that into perpetuity. And what they end up having is that, like in the Colorado River, 110% or more than 100% of the Colorado River is allocated, which is why the Colorado River no longer reaches the ocean.
Yeah.
So what I would do is I would immediately change things like that. Those are just first steps that could be done. I would take the U.S. Navy and I would use it to immediately start hunting down illegal commercial fishers, you know, around the world. And, you know, right now, the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized to a value greater than the catch.
Right.
So, you know, there's all sorts of things like that that could be done that would be, or hell, just get rid of the U.S. military and then you have plenty of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like last year, there's a species of wolf called the red wolf, and it is not doing very well, and it's only located at this point in the southeastern United States, very small population. And for a while, they were having a breeding and reintroduction program, and that got defunded just this last year. And, you know, that the amount of money that it took, I'm making up the amount, I don't remember what it was like $1 million, something
right.
Completely trivial compared to how much a new aircraft carrier costs or something. And so that's another thing, is we would have, is if I were making, I would immediately just, you know, take all that money. Oh, here's another story, is that in my book, Culture and Make-Believe, I wrote about this story, that George McGovern, he was a liberal senator back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he also ran for president against Nixon. Anyway, he, at one point, he went into a military contractor and was talking to somebody there, and he said, you know, you're basically, you don't actually care about military contracting, right? You really care about making money. And the guy said, yeah. He said, if we could get you contracts to build school buses instead of building bombers, would you do it? And the guy said, of course we would. And then they both just started laughing their heads off because they knew this would never happen.
Right.
So long story short, I wish we lived in a sane culture, but if we lived in a sane culture, we wouldn't be doing this in the first place. So
right.
No, it's gonna come crashing down. It's not going to come crashing down in a sort of biblical apocalypse where it all happens overnight, you know,
right.
And there's walls falling like the walls of Jericho. That, unfortunately, or there's a sense, this is unfortunately, in which there's a sense of, in which it's not going to happen that way. And the reason I say unfortunately is because 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species are going to go extinct tomorrow, and 200 the day after that. And the world is in desperate need of this way of life to stop. And I think, I mean, there are those, Guy McPherson, for example, who believe that global warming is going to happen. He thinks that humans will be extinct within 15 years. And
from
I respect
now?
Guy. From global warming will destroy agriculture.
Hmm.
And I have great respect for Guy McPherson, and I also like him very much as a person.
Mm-hmm.
He's great and all that. The one place I disagree with him on is I think it's not a good idea to actually put a number.
Right.
Because if you put a number, you know, in 16 years, then it's like, oops, I guess, you know.
I guess
so. What I would say is where I do agree with him is that I think that, my mom is 83, and she and I have this conversation about once every 2 or 3 weeks that she is really glad. I mean, she doesn't want to die, but she is so glad that she's not younger because she doesn't want to see what's coming, and it's coming so fast. And
mm-hmm.
It's the same with me. I don't want to see what's coming. I mean, there are mainstream news is saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish by within 35 years. That's you said you're 25, so yeah,
mm-hmm.
when you're my age, I'm 55, and so, you know, if it's devoid of fish in 35 years, that means in 30 years it's, you know, essentially devoid of fish.
Right.
And that's, you know, I don't envy anyone younger the world they're going to see. And so, no, I think that this way of life can't last any longer, and I don't want it to last any longer because it's killing the planet. This is one of the things also that just kills me, is that I am so angry, and I've been writing about this for years, I am so
right.
angry that environmentalism has been converted from about attempting to protect the natural world over to attempting to sustain this unsustainable culture.
And when did you see that start to happen? Like, was there a clear notion of when that began to happen, or just gradually it was diverted?
Well, okay, so there's two things. One is that in some ways this goes to a rift that has been in environmentalism for at least 120 years.
Mm-hmm.
That this was the fight between John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. That Gifford Pinchot thought that, okay, the way that the whole national forest system was created in the first place
mm-hmm.
was explicitly to keep it out of the hands of the timber barons.
Mm-hmm.
Because the timber barons were taking land everywhere, and they were just cutting the hell out of it as they continue to do today.
Right.
And so there was a big fight as they were creating the whole national forest system as to whether it should be basically all wilderness, which was basically John, and this is, I'm giving a completely, this is such a superficial exploration of this that it's almost wrong, but it still gives the flavor well enough. Anyway, so John Muir's idea was that it should basically all be wilderness, all just left aside. And Gifford Pinchot's idea was that they should be essentially working forests, but they would be worked by the government as opposed to private lands. So it would be basically as it is now, that there are better restrictions, but still it's used for exploitation
mm-hmm.
and, or as he would say, natural resource extraction. And so this is in one sense a fight that's been going on for quite a while, but it really has made this transformation over the last, there's I'm gonna write a book one of these days with a friend of mine, actually it'll be with several friends, about how neoliberalism has destroyed all radical movements. And
Please do.
So we have Gifford Pinchot and John Muir in the background, and then in the 70s, this whole neoliberalism starts really getting put forward. And in a nutshell, the neoliberal idea is that solutions are personal as opposed to large-scale social with organized resistance. And this has really destroyed feminism. It's destroyed environmentalism. You know, in the 1980s was the first time that newspapers started to refer to human beings as consumers more often than as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, because if they can get you to perceive yourself as a consumer as opposed to a citizen, then that means that your range of resistance, either consume or don't consume, and it's a purely personal act. As opposed to if you're a citizen, you can consume or not consume. You can also organize. You can vote, not vote. You can boycott. You can resist. You can, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it. But as a consumer, you don't get to do that. So that's one of the things that's happened, is that conversion from organized political resistance to individual action. And that really happened through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then there was another very pernicious thing that's happened too, that's happened all across society, which is it's partly postmodernism, and it also is a human supremacism, and it's based on this notion that what we feel is more important than what is. And it's also, this is tremendously deep in this culture, that what humans create has value and what non-humans create does not. And, you know, when we think of great pieces of art, we think about, you know, Michelangelo, or we think about Leonardo da Vinci, or we think about, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter. It could be...
Right. They're all people.
For God's sake, it could be Harry Potter for that. You know, it's like, if humans create something, it's great. But if... Why is a sunrise not a beautiful piece of art? Why is a sunset not a beautiful piece of art? Why is... Because in this culture, we believe that those aren't intentional. I remember years and years ago, I was interviewing Neil Everndon, and he's a great philosopher. He wrote The Natural Alien, most important book I ever read, I think. Anyway, it was in Toronto, and I interviewed him in the fall. And as I was driving up to interview him, I met a friend in Ohio, and we drove up. And it was beautiful fall colors on the trees. And I remember saying to him, you know, there's a part of me that just wants to say these trees are showboating, they're showing off.
Mm-hmm.
He just looked at me and said, why do you think they aren't? What makes you think they're not? Why can't non-humans love beauty, you know? Why can't they produce beauty? And that was incredibly important to me. Anyway, the point is that we believe that what we believe is more important than what's real. And this has gotten much, much worse with the internet, with computers, that,
right,
you know, we spend what we think that we can create, because we create a virtual world, we've created a world. And we think that a great example of this is that I have found out a couple of years ago that I've got clogged arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And the arteries were getting, I mean, I had pain in my heart, but at the time I didn't have any health insurance, so I couldn't go to a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I got on Obamacare, which, for what it's worth, has worked great for me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got on Obamacare, and I went to see a doctor, and I said, you know, the weird thing is that my heart is hurting less than it did when this problem first started. And he said, no, that's not weird at all, because what happens is when your body senses a clogged artery, it throws out capillaries around it. It grows new blood vessels to go around the clog. And this is the coolest damn thing, because what this means, here's my point, is that when humans do open heart surgery consciously, when we cut open somebody's chest and we do surgery to do bypass surgery,
mm-hmm,
then we think we're the smartest people in the world. But your body does it, and when our body does it, we don't think of that as a miracle.
Right.
But our bodies, everybody's bodies are doing miracles all the time, but those are consistently devalued. And what do people want? Oh, it's like right after Fukushima, there's this great and horrible line by a Japanese energy minister said that the reason they can't stop using nuclear power is because nobody can imagine living without electricity. Well, first off, about a third or half of the people in the world right now live without electricity, so they're imagining it quite well. Right. Second is, humans live without electricity until 100 years ago, and they did very, very well. And on the other hand, how many people do you ever hear say, and especially people in public positions, I can't imagine living without tigers. I can't imagine living without polar bears. I can't imagine living without salmon. You know, what we can't imagine living without... Oh, I saw this thing in the New York Times editorial, and I hope I'm getting this point across by just showing these examples. Oh, I'm going to give a couple examples. First off, every time there's some article about some endangered species or some species going extinct, every time they have to bring it back to how that's going to affect the economy. Every time.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, you know, the oceans are acidifying, and that means that clams and oysters and all them are not able to make their shells. And what this means is the seafood industry is going to collapse. It's like, are you kidding me?
No, you're
allowed to swear. The oceans are dying, and what you care about is how it's going to affect the economy?
Right.
Every time, this is what it's about. Anyway, so this New York Times article, there was even one about the deep oceans, about how this culture's pollution is going to really affect the deep oceans even. And then they were saying, you know, this might not matter to you as much as a traffic report. It's like, really? Really? Do you think traffic reports are more important than the health of most of the life on this water planet? But anyway, they said this may not seem important to you, but many of these species are commercially valuable. I was like, really? That's what's important. Anyway, so it was a New York Times editorial about how we need to make an ark for the Anthropocene. And I don't want to get into the Anthropocene thing right now. We can do it later if you want. But
sure.
But how, basically, it's about how people are trying desperately to figure out which species to save. It's like, do we want to save this one that might make money? Do we want to save this one because it's important to the, you know, because it's pretty? You know, do we want to save charismatic megafauna? What do we want to save? And the thing that killed me about this whole stupid article, or stupid editorial, was that they're talking about which creatures we will cause to go extinct and making choice on those, but never once was mentioned which pieces of technology should we allow to go extinct.
Right.
Never once was it mentioned, should we allow the Internet to go extinct? Not even mentioning Internet pornography, you know? It's like, should we allow iPads to go extinct, or whatever the newest iPhones, whatever the hell they're called now? And that's what I mean by this culture values what it creates more than what the world creates. And this is happening everywhere, and that's a big problem. This is part of this, it goes way back, and it goes all the way back to the beginnings of monotheism. It goes to the divine right of kings. This whole... the great chain of being, where you go from God is perfect, and then there's angels, then there's kings, then priests, then normal men, then normal women, and then animals and plants, then all the way down this scale. And this infects every part of our life, where we believe that there's this notion that mind is over matter, and that mind is intelligent, and that matter is not, and that humans are intelligent, and then God is perfect, and mm-hmm. humans are a battleground of good mind and bad body, and
but
animals are just
even
body
within
plant.
The Christian side of that. Like, if you believe in Christianity, I mean, the first part of it, the very first part of it is like God saying, like, this is the earth, like, I've entrusted you with the earth, take care of it, like. Not exploit it, and I think that's why I'm always most confused by Christians. It's like, that's the first part of your religion. The very first part is God created this, so therefore it should be respected. And secondly, he entrusted it to you. Now, if God has entrusted something to you, I would imagine that if you believe that he's an all-powerful, perfect being, then the things he's entrusted to you are perfect, and therefore they should be treated with a great deal of respect. And I just, that's always confused me. That's
who's Louis C.K. is a comedian. He
mm-hmm.
he has a nice bit on this where basically God comes back and says, "What did you do?"
Yeah, you know? You assholes.
"I can't believe you did this. I
right.
gave you one thing to do, which is to just take care of this place, and you messed it all up."
Right.
Or we can, you know, we can boil this down, this notion of valuing stuff. It's like we value money over
right.
valuing the air we breathe. And that's
poor
completely
people.
Nuts. And so, anyway, that's gotten much worse in the last 30 years. It's gotten infinitely worse as even so-called environmentalists say explicitly that they are attempting to sustain this way of life as opposed
mm-hmm.
to... And it's a tremendous coup. I mean, the whole global warming thing is very, very... The whole climate movement is very, very interesting and sad in this way that so many of the climate activists say, we are not environmental activists. And they say, we explicitly, we are here attempting to maintain this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they will come up with, you know, plans to save civilization. And, you know, they will say that what's at stake is civilization. It's like, no, I'm sorry, what's at stake is life on the planet.
Right.
And that's not, but that's not what's important to them. And, you know, this goes back to the question of, you said something about indigenous humans, and so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And also what they've said that means is that we have to break our loyalty to the system, and we have to make our loyalty to the real world, to
mm-hmm.
to the land, to the water, to the air, to the creatures. And this is I forgot what I was going to say.
That's okay.
Anyway, so that transition has been going on. You know, the preference for this culture versus the planet has been here for the beginnings of this culture, but there has been this acceleration of it over the last 30 years that is very dreadful.
Mm-hmm. My last thing, you had mentioned neoliberalism earlier and the way that it ended, radical environmentalism and radical, almost anything radical. And that's, I mean, a lot of the people that I talk to on this podcast are... or that I'm attempting to talk to are radicals from the 60s and 70s, mainly because it seemed like it just stopped. And I've studied all these radical movements with a fervor, but I've never figured out why it stopped, and you presented this answer of neoliberalism. And my I guess, curiosity, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but like, why did that arise? What happened? Was it a manufactured... Why was it manufactured to be that way?
Well, I think that there are a bunch of answers, and one of them is that it's very interesting what happened in the American South after the American Civil War, that the American Civil War ended chattel slavery. That's not true. It made chattel slavery illegal.
Right.
But what happened is that in the American South, they were able to then pass laws that would create a de facto slavery without the chattel slavery. And one of the lessons from this is that if you figure out a way to stop some injustice, those who were perpetrating the injustice in the first place are going to figure out a way to put it back in
mm-hmm.
under a different name.
So like now the prison movement.
I'm sorry?
So like now it would be, the next step would be the prison movement that happened since the civil rights movement.
Yeah, exactly. So if you figure out, yeah, exactly. So anytime we come up with a... And one of the things that this culture is completely brilliant at is co-opting movements for sanity and turning them back to bad ends. So you get labor unions, which are
mm-hmm.
a great idea, and then they at some point get captured.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this capturing is completely intentional. I remember reading, I don't remember, oh, was it Interstate Commerce Commission, I think, but I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure. This is from Culture Make-Believe, and I wrote that, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was tremendous outcry against the railroads for having monopolies and being unsafe and for doing all sorts of terrible things. And at some point, the federal government created, I believe it's the Interstate Commerce Commission, but we'll just pretend it is for now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they created this commission to oversee it, and the railroad people were furious. And, mm-hmm. of course, just then as now, the industrialists and the capitalists were good friends with the people in the cabinet. So he wrote to his buddy, and he's like, what are you doing to me? Why could you do this? And the guy said, look, we created this to make it to protect you, basically, from the outrage of people, because if the people had their way, they would cut off your heads.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we've created this commission that will seem like it's going to help the people, but actually it's going to help you.
Right.
And we see this all the time, too. A great example, too, is U.S. Fish and Wildlife, where many, many individual people who work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife are great.
Mm-hmm.
Many individuals are wonderful. But the agency as a whole has been entirely captured for, God, at least 30 years.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that happens, is that these agencies, you call it like a natural history of an agency, that it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the FDA that is supposed to, protect people from the pharmaceutical industry, getting captured by the pharmaceutical industry. This is how the system works. It's going to take a movement, in a different way. I've never forgotten something a friend of mine who was, I was a kid in the 60s. I was born in 1960, so I was very young through the whole thing. I had this friend who's maybe 15 years older. He said the moment he knew the 60s were over is when he saw a psychedelic advertisement for 7-Up.
Oh.
I was like, oh, okay, yep, they've captured it. It's done. So
yeah.
This is one of the things that happens, is you make some movement, and then it's going to get captured, corrupted, turned into something to make money. And once again, this happens consistently. How do you get environmentalism, which is, it's an extraordinary coup on the part of the climate activists that they have been able to get 100,000 people to march somewhere or more people to march somewhere. And if you ask the individuals who are marching, why are you marching? They say to save the planet. And if you ask them what their demands are, is they want subsidies for the solar industry.
Hmm.
That is a huge coup. That's a public relations complete victory for capitalism and for an industrial sector.
Yeah.
And this is what happens. It's the same. Feminism has gone from being something about protecting women and getting women's liberation to nowadays there are feminists who promote pornography, so-called feminists, third wave, who promote pornography, prostitution. It's absolutely stunning. And this is once again what this culture consistently does, is take these things. Christianity is a great example too. Let's take it at face value. You got Jesus walking around talking about loving your neighbor and talking about, driving moneylenders from the temple.
Right.
And then how many years did it take before Christians were persecuting
dominant
other
religion.
People?
150.
Yeah, not very long. And so this is something that we have to really come to grips with, is this ability, this cultural ability to, I want to bring in one more piece of this puzzle,
mm-hmm.
which I keep thinking about this, that I think it's Max Planck. It's one of the scientists. I can't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Max Planck. Said that the way that paradigms shift in, the way that new theories take over in science is not really because one side convinces the other, but it's because one side dies out. They
mm-hmm.
grow old. The actual individuals who have it don't change their mind. You're not going to get some committed slave owner. Very, very rarely is some committed slave owner going to wake up and go, oh my gosh, that was really evil, wasn't it?
Right.
Instead, what's going to happen, social change takes a much longer time. I think also about something that Peggy Reeves Danday talked about, that she's studied the cross-cultural rates of rape, and why some cultures are high rape cultures and some are low rape cultures. and we can talk about that if you want, but the key thing right now, the thing I want to bring up in this subject,
mm-hmm.
is that one of the markers of a high-rate culture is a history of ecological dislocation within the last 300 to 400 to 500 years. And one of the things that says to me is when a culture gets stressed, oftentimes men take it out on women. But that's,
mm-hmm.
that's not what I really, that's what I want to emphasize right now. What I want to emphasize right now is what that suggests to me is after a severe trauma, it can take a culture 500 years to metabolize that trauma and to get to be okay again.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a long time. This goes back to your question, too. Are we going to have some sort of voluntary transformation or will it be a crash? No, because a voluntary transformation, I think for a culture to go from being nasty to being a really good culture, I think takes several hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that because each generation has to be a little bit better than the one before. It doesn't happen where there's these miracles. That doesn't even happen on a personal level very often, where, I mean, how many people have you known who have been, say, just not even necessarily jerks, but just severely traumatized? They don't wake up one day and go, oh, everything's okay now.
Right.
You know, it can take an entire lifetime to try to work through that trauma.
Yeah.
And it's the same with these cultural shifts. I want to give one more example of how this culture, I think, co-opts everything, which is my friend Frances Morlepe, one of the things she says is that gives her great optimism, is she asks, why did people stop believing in the divine right of kings? And her answer is, they just did. At some point they believed in it, and at some point they didn't. And
right.
that gives her great, great hope that at some point people will no longer believe in the divine right of corporations or believe in any of this stuff. And she has a more optimistic view than I, that my view on that is that it hasn't really changed. They still believe in the divine right of kings. It's just that now it's the divine right of human beings. And it's
right.
also the divine right of machines.
Or the divine
machines
right
machines and human...
Like you
I'm
said,
sorry, go ahead.
Or like you said, the divine right of corporations. They're still kings. They're just called
exactly.
CEOs now.
Exactly. And so I think that this notion, this hierarchical notion of the divine right of kings, you know, did get undercut or did go away in a sense. But it didn't really go away. The underlying impulse is still there.
Yeah.
And that's what's really scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not going to expound too much on this because it's gotten me in trouble in the past. But, I mean, the perfect example, people are saying that Donald Trump would be a great leader. Why? Because he's done a great job leading a business. And so, obviously, if you can do a great job leading a business, you can do a great job leading a country, which I think just takes away from even the idea that, like, the country isn't made up of people, it isn't made up of land, it's a business.
Right.
And so, of course, our king should be a business, you know, a business
yep.
person.
Right.
And I think that that's been the shift that we've seen, you know, dramatically since the 60s. And I think the one thing that, and I think we'll end on this little bit and your thoughts on it, but I think for me the one thing that I've seen in the last couple of years, and again I'm young, but I have an obsession with radicals of the days of old, is the Black Lives Movement and people of color, and they're after, you know, from what I've seen, almost a quietness from people of color over the last 15, 20 years. They're beginning to assemble again, and I think that white culture has always looked to people of color almost as a vanguard or a people that go ahead to say, like, it's okay to rebel again. Like, you can, you're, it's okay to be radical and it's okay to rebel. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I understand what you're saying. And
yeah.
I think that there is something to that. And I think another thing to watch out for white people is that I think we also have a tendency to put people of color on the front line.
Right.
And, oh, it's, you know, we valorize it when they do it, but when we do it, it's really scary. You know, a great example of that is 1997, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA. It's a rebel group in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a rebel group in Peru. And I sent a note to the Nation asking if they would want to see it, to see my interview. And they were very excited and called me and said, so, hey, this is great. So we'd be very interested. What's your focus of it? And I said, well, the focus is going to be to talk about the resistance down there and then to talk about how it's really important, you know, that you can't just stop capitalism there. But you have to bring this home and you have to stop capitalism here, too, in the United States.
Right.
And suddenly they were not interested in the piece at all. You know, it's one thing if some brown people in another country are going to rebel, or poor people in some other country are going to rebel against capitalism, but the notion of rebelling against it at home, like, not so interesting.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I guess for me, the hope that I'm given by that is, you know, the civil rights, I think, was, in my opinion, was the movement that had sparked a lot of the other 60s movements, in my opinion. So my hope is just that, and my question is, have you seen any, has there been more radical environmentalism sparked in the last few years, or is that not something that you've seen?
Well, I think, you know, I'm seeing movements in a bunch of different directions. I think as as, you know, capitalism continues to collapse, there will be those mainstream people who do everything they can to try to perpetuate it for 1 minute longer.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about the Trumps. I'm talking about a lot of the. You know, those who call themselves environmentalists who are trying to, you know, run this on solar instead of coal or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then and they're trying to just run it a little bit longer. And so there's that direction. There's also those, increasingly we will see people who are like survivalists, who are like, things are so messed up that there's nothing I can do. I just need to prepare a little hidey hole for myself and my family, and you know,
right,
get guns and food. And then we're also seeing, you know, increasingly, like there's the organization Deep Green Resistance,
mm-hmm,
of which I'm one of the founders. That
right.
That there are people joining it all the time. People who recognize that this way of life is inherently unsustainable, and that this world is worth fighting for. And that I'm actually pretty surprised at how much it has grown.
Mm-hmm.
And surprise is not the right word. Pleased is a better word.
Right.
Anyway, so I think that there is, I think that what's going to happen is, as things become increasingly chaotic, there will be just this wider variety of responses, some of which will be sane and some of which will be not sane, and some of which will be, and we're going to see people, you know, like this Malheur, this right-wing takeover of Malheur, where
mm-hmm,
there are those who are increasingly strident about killing every last tree and every last
right.
Native creature. And that's completely to be expected as well. And I think...
Why?
There's this great word, this great phrase called aggrieved entitlement, which is where those who feel entitled... and are feeling that entitlement threatened in any way will oftentimes respond with great violence. So this is why, for example, after the American Civil War, lynching skyrocketed, because no longer did the white access to the labor of the enslaved peoples, formerly enslaved peoples, was threatened, and they responded with great violence to try to maintain that entitlement. there is, I think, almost no way more sure. I remember that quote from the Japanese environmental minister about, or I'm sorry, energy minister,
yeah,
about we can't imagine it without electricity. Nobody can imagine it without electricity. Can you imagine the sort of outrage there would be if all of a sudden the government decided to turn off television?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the level of outrage would be extraordinary. Or if they decided no longer can you have plastic bottles because there's too much plastic in the ocean. So we are stopping all plastic production tomorrow. People would completely freak. They would tear you limb from limb.
Yeah.
And that's that aggrieved entitlement when you feel, and you know, we've seen this before. Have you ever noticed this, that let's say person A and person B are friends,
mm-hmm,
and person A loans person B $100 or $500, it's a significant amount of money.
Sure.
They loan them some money, and then at some point person A asks person B for the money back.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever noticed how often person B gets mad?
Yeah.
It's nuts. It's like, you did me the favor, I'm sorry, I did you the favor of loaning you the money, and now you're mad at me because I'm asking for it back?
Right.
Because people start to feel entitled. It's the same with all this other. They feel entitled to run their cattle on public land.
Right.
And they feel entitled to, you know, go down the list. And so when people feel entitled and those entitlements are taken away, they get really, really pissed. So that's where aggrieved entitlement comes from. And that's why I think things are going to get worse and worse and worse socially. This is another thing we know, is when a mill closes, violence against women goes up. And people take it out, and men take it out. And when a mill closes, you see racial violence by the whites against members of other races go up too. And you know, as capitalism collapses, we're going to see more and more of this. This is why this sort of racism, misogyny, all this is coming out is just so completely expected.
I guess my final question would be, what can we as people that are doing activism help to soften that blow of entitlement against, you know, people of color, the environment, you know, people that you know, whether human or non, that we're fighting for?
Well, I think that one of the things we need to do is to think very clearly and to think very carefully about our loyalties and to make our loyalty to the victims of this culture and to make our loyalty to the women, make our loyalty to the non-humans, make our loyalty to people of color. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that no woman can do anything wrong. It doesn't mean that no person of color can ever do anything wrong. And
no.
There are women who are assholes, and there are people of color who are assholes. It's just
O.J. Simpson.
those work for me.
Yeah.
And and there are poor women of color who, I mean, it goes across, those are both rich people. There are poor people who are jerks, too. You know, it's like,
for sure.
There are people who are simply jerks. This just happens. My point is that making your loyalty to a class does not mean you have to like every single one of them.
Right. It just means you.
But you have to make the loyalty to them, and we need to make. I mean, if the choice is between, you need to then step in to defend, find what you love, and then defend your beloved. That's a really, really important thing. So, you know, make your loyalty to the victims of this culture, and then start defending them.
Okay.
So that's what we should do.
Perfect. I think that's a great stopping point. Thank you so much. I'll send you the information about when it goes up. It'll probably be a couple of weeks because I've got a little bit of a backlog. More people said yes than I had expected, so they go up every 2 weeks. So I'll send you and your assistant an email when it's about to go up and give you the link and all that, and you can share it however you see fit or, you know, not. But thank you so much for just spending your time talking to me, and it meant a lot to me, and I learned a lot, and so, you know, all goals were met by me.
Thanks for your great questions, and
yeah.
I mean, I, It's very clear. I mean, you're way smarter than I was at 25. So.
Oh, thanks, man.
Okay, well, I hope you have a great day.
Yeah, you too. All right,
okay,
talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.